at the moon. Don't know or what I am in your arms a while. Face a baby for it knows to smile. But there's no trace. Everywhere I turn, you kiss my face. Sadhguru Nath Maharaj ki jai. Namaste and blessings. The Swami welcomes you with great love and great respect from the heart of all. Welcome, whether you're live or in the archive, to Meditative Living. This is your host, Swami Shivananda Giri. And this Swami is a master and instructor of the path of Mahadeva Mahayoga. And today, we will be continuing our exploration of the authoritative Guru Gita of His Holiness Mahamandaleshwar Paramahamsa Swarupananda Vishwaguru Maharaj of Los Angeles, California, who in 2007 became the very first white-skinned American-born human being to be invited into the rank of the 80 Mahamandaleshwar, whose dharma it is to disseminate and defend Sanatana Dharma, the eternal natural way on this particular planet. Of course, for those unfamiliar with the term Sanatana Dharma, it's more popularly known as Hinduism, which is really a geographical kind of thing, and not fairly representing the enormous number of traditions and such within the vast field of Sanatana Dharma. So on today's show, episode 9, in the Guru Gita series here on www.type1radio.com, we rejoin the text, which, by the way, the Sanskrit original Guru Gita was translated for this book by Acharya Padma Najendra, and the commentary was written by Swami Anantanandagiri, who is the Swami's very good friend and former student, who then went directly under our guru until he attained his Swamihood. Now, as we go through this, you will hear the various verses, the way this Swami is going to say it, which are actually called shlokas, that are numbered. Then you will hear Swami Anantananda's commentary. And if this Swami has anything to add, I'll do that following. So let us pick up with number 83. Keep in mind, this is the text of a conversation between Lord Shiva and his wife Parvati, who had asked the question that had never been asked to Shiva before, which was, what is a guru? How does a normal human being become like you? Now, she was already fully realized and liberated at the point of asking this. And the reason she asked it was because Shiva was sitting at the time that this takes place and giving discourse on all sorts of areas of yoga in the very first yoga teaching that ever occurred. And he was giving this to the Sapta Rishis, the seven first students of yoga. And Shiva was the very first yoga instructor on this particular planet. So when Parvati walked up, as Shiva is giving these lessons and discourse, she observes Shiva bowing. And this just freaks her out, because Shiva is the god of the gods. Even Indra, the king of the gods, bows to Shiva. Vishnu, the sustainer, Brahma, the creator, both bow to Shiva. Who on earth or in heaven or anywhere else could Shiva be bowing to? She'd never seen this. So, Shiva says, let me explain. Because, see, this process for her of becoming enlightened and liberated was made very easy for her by Shiva because of their intimate relationship being husband and wife. And don't think sex when you think intimate, okay? Think close, without obstruction, without doubts and concerns, okay? He told her what to do, she did it, she got the effect, boom! So she's watching him tell these guys sitting around him all this stuff, and she's like, how does this get so complicated? It was very easy, but see, so understand the perspective that's being represented here in the text. Number 83. Shiva says to Parvati, men roam endlessly, afflicted by the three kinds of fire. Thus, they suffer in samsara. The water from the guru's feet is like the sacred Ganges for such souls. To such a guru, I pay my respects. Swami Anantananda's commentary. Jataragni is the stomach fire. Dhatu Agni, of which there is seven in that category, is responsible for the formation of bodily tissues. And Bhutagni, of which there are five, is responsible for the integration of the five elements into what we know as the body. This equals 13 individual agnis, fires, or metabolic processes, which fall into three categories. These are the processes responsible for the formation and maintenance of the body. The guru is that Shiva who dissolves the erroneous identification with the body-mind complex. If the afflictions that man suffers due to his bondage to samsara are these various fires, then the feet of the guru are the sanctifying river Ganges, the sacred river that extinguishes the fire of worldliness. The bodily processes do actually continue after self-realization, but the equanimous yogi is no longer afflicted by anything external to the big S self. Kindly allow this Swami to expand a bit on this. You have to understand, when going over Sanskrit text or anything coming from Sanskrit text, the Sanskrit texts are dialectic and they are largely metaphor. They do not spell things out in great detail. They give what can pass through time, through the writing, a framework, a basis, a starting point from which an individual can learn. Now, if, let's say, in the context of the Western scholars who became huge fans of the Vedas long ago, Emerson and such, they had the scholarly ability to read the English translations of the Sanskrit and were greatly inspired even by that. But in order to fully unpack these little sentences called sutras, which means thread, because a sutra is a thread that runs through the wholeness of the tapestry of all that is to be learned. Okay? More metaphor here. So one can pick up the words and have some ability to grok that, all well and good. But in order to really deeply, permanently understand what is being spoken of and what the ancient texts point at but cannot say, it requires a guru, one who knows. He knows all of it, front to back, top to bottom, side to side, inside, outside, all of it. And a satguru, as we'll see later, there are a number of different classifications of gurus. Okay? A satguru is a true guru who sits at the highest level possible. and yet is in a physical body and has the capability to explain the ins, the outs, the ups, the downs, the good sides, the bad sides, what you need to look for, and how to get there. When it comes to what the scriptures, what the texts can only point at, but they can't give you the exact how to do these things. Okay? Number 84. For those bitten by the serpent of ignorance, there is no doctor other than the guru who alone knows the medicine of the supreme mantra of knowledge. 85. Shiva says, the guru is the cause of the universe. He is the bridge across the ocean of transmigratory existence. He is the Lord of all sciences, and he is Shiva only. To him, I offer my respects. Swami Anantananda's commentary. Several points are made here, most of which have been addressed already. Presently, I will limit the discussion to the notion posited here that Shiva slash Guru is the Lord of all sciences, since it is one that we haven't seen up to this point. Science can be defined as the systematic study of the structure and behavior of the physical and natural world through observation and experimentation. Each scientific discovery uncovered by mankind is effectively a successful attempt at illuminating an aspect of the nature of Shiva. Since everything is Shiva, and since Shiva has the innate capacity for self-reflective awareness, it follows that Paramashiva should be completely omniscient at the sphere of pure consciousness absolute. Everything that exists is Shiva's experiment and is observed by him. His knowledge of the physical and natural world is utterly complete. Thus, he is the Lord of all sciences. Shiva says, the root of meditation is the guru's form. The root of worship is the guru's feet. The root of mantra is the guru's speech. And the root of liberation is guru's grace. Swami Anantananda's commentary. The world of manifest existence is often likened to a vast tree, originating from the seed of consciousness absolute, the guru. All the universe is latent in the seed that is consciousness, but has yet to be actualized at this level of existence. In the seed, the tree exists, but only as potential. The seed emits the tree as differentiated aspects of itself, trunk, branches, bark, leaves, buds, fruit, etc. Consciousness as the infinite variety of particular forms. The mission of the seeker is to return from the extremities of the world back to its point of origin, the root of the great world tree. The Guru Tattva, or Guru Principle, is that very root. The personal guru is the temporal emissary of the Absolute. Meditation, growing from absorption in the form of one's guru, is a fine meditation indeed. There is no purer worship than that stemming from reverence cultivated at the guru's feet. The guru's every utterance is mantra. The guru is the living, grace-bestowing power of God. Grace is a frequency. The individual, whether consciously or unconsciously, is turning the dial of a radio. And the personal guru is the most auspicious spot on that dial. To tune into the guru is to cut to the heart of all of the various technologies that have been promoted throughout human history for the sake of spiritual advancement. To dial into this frequency is the essence of all spiritual work. To do so successfully and to stay for the duration of the program is to return to the root of all existence. Shiva, consciousness, the guru, the self, the seed, all that was, is, or ever will be. Kindly allow this, Swami, to add. This is really spelled out very well by Swami Anantananda Giri here. This Swami likes to say, you have to go in your practice with your focus and your experience inward, upward, and outward. You must go within the body and within the mind. You must go upward through the spinal cord, through the mental processes, and then you must go outward, outside the physical chakra system, and outside the mental constructs and processes. Even when you have hit what is outside of those two, you generally do not stay there long. You get a glimpse, and these glimpses are rather frequently here in the West misinterpreted as enlightenment. They are nothing of the sort. They are an enlightened experience, yes. But the objective is to get to that perspective and keep it, so that it is never away from you, and you are always resting in that while still functioning within the world. There are two types of freedom discussed in the ancient Sanskrit. There is jivan mukti, or freedom mukti, while in a jiva, or embodied. Okay, this is the people who go through the whole process to the end result and stay there. Yet they continue to run around the world in a body. But they are aware of both what lies outside of space and time and what is going on within space and time. These are relatively rare. The majority of humans who attain mukti attain what is called videha mukti, which takes place as one loses the body completely. And they, for any number of reasons, are not either interested in or capable of maintaining the physical and mental complex we think of as what goes by our names. Now, this is not really death, although it is the end of the functioning of the physical, but that's far more like a vehicle. It's just quit working. But you've not ended, your energies have reached a point where that can no longer limit or hold on to the level you're at. So it's not a bad thing, okay? But that is the far more common occurrence, is that one reaches the supreme, and then, again, for any number of different reasons, the body is dropped. Some become what is called jivanmuktis, or freed while embodied, liberated, but able to walk around in the world, looking, acting just like anybody else, but knowing and fully having all that is capable to have. And most of these won't even talk about these matters because they'll be largely misunderstood, and they're very aware of this. So even rarer amongst the jivanmuktis are the ones who make it to that and are tasked with becoming a living guru. Okay? That's a bit of the how to break down what is going on. Sonic, let's go ahead and do the bottom of the hour break, and we'll be back with number 87 here on Meditative Living.
Shivaya, Shivaya, Namah 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 Shivaya, Shivaya, Namah 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 Shivaya,
Welcome back to Meditative Living with Swami Shivananda Giri. Let us continue with the authoritative Guru Gita. Number 87, Shiva says to Parvati, neither the merits extended over the seven oceans, nor those obtained by bathing in sacred rivers, are equal to the merit obtained by even 1,000th part of the water that has been used to wash the Guru's feet. Swami Anantananda's commentary. There are many sacred waters the world over whose power to heal and to bless are well known. Some of these are well-known sites of pilgrimage, and for good reason. Yet, no water is as holy as the water that has been sanctified by the Guru. One need not go any further than the feet of the Guru in order to earn the highest merit that can be attained. Kindly allow this, Swami, to point out again. When the term guru is being used, whether it is in the verses themselves or in Swami Anantananda's commentaries, you've got to be able to discern the appropriate context. Are we speaking of God, Source, all that is, all that can teach? Or are we speaking of the limited, living human being who carries the responsibility and ability to guru? Remember, guru simply means the light that removes the darkness, or the knowledge that removes the ignorance. Okay? Number 88. Shiva says, if Lord Shiva becomes angry with one, the guru can protect him. If the guru becomes angry with one, there is no one to protect him. Therefore, one should find a guru and take shelter in him. Swami Anantananda is coming. The guru is not subordinate to anyone or anything, but the entire created order of things is subordinate to the guru. Even the entire hierarchy of gods is answerable to the guru. The entire universe originates from and rests upon guru alone. The guru protection plan, as my guru calls it, is the real deal and is a worthwhile investment. Number 89. Shiva says to Parvati, just as the butterfly flies from one flower to another, looking for nectar to quench its thirst, the disciple should look from one guru to another until his thirst for knowledge is quenched. Swami Anantananda's commentary. The scriptures frequently emphasize the benefit of keeping the company of sages. The more time one can occupy in their presence, actually with them, talking to them, the better. The more the merrier. A whole host of benefits can be attributed to simply soaking up the presence of saints. However, when one's resolve becomes firm that suffering must be rooted out once and for all, it becomes necessary to become completely surrendered to the feet of the living guru, as detailed in the introduction. Usually, it is necessary to cultivate such surrender to the outer guru, the living guru, before the same surrender to the inner guru can be accomplished, simply because our focus tends to be directed outwards. Surrender to the outer guru fixes this. There should be only one outer guru. Guruji says, our guru, one person, one sadguru. That is the rule. End quote. Addressing the subject in greater detail, he told me the first time I ever met him in person, I don't believe in guru hopping. Every time you switch from one system to another, you're essentially starting over from the beginning. Think of it this way. If you're digging a well, your objective is to hit water. You're going to reach your objective more quickly and with less effort by digging in one place. If you can't make it more than a couple feet down before giving up and trying somewhere else, the likelihood of your success diminishes to virtually none. This sort of approach will slow you down, if nothing else. It is good to pick a course of action and stick to it. Otherwise, all you have to show for all your hard work is a bunch of half-dug holes. The distinction between keeping the company of sages and surrendering to the guru is simply one of commitment. Holy company, or satsang, is always better for one's welfare than worldly company when there is an option. However, There is a time for just sitting with holy people, and then there is a time for deeply imbibing their words or assimilating them into one's very being. This is the time to lose yourself in the guru. This is the time for the guru to become more important than your ego. This is the time for everything to become guru only. The Swami throws in, for any doubters, that last mention of guru involves both contexts. Because by doing that, you will come to find yourself is that too. Mm-hmm. Number 90. Shiva says to Parvati, I salute the 2 feet of the guru, which are beyond speech and mind, each shining a different color, namely white and red. They are the form of the supreme Shiva Shakti. Swami Anantananda's commentary. Shiva is that aspect of consciousness absolute, which is infinite, but unmanifest potential. Shiva is utter repose and stillness. He is beyond all. He is represented by the color white. His consort is his power, his Shakti. She is his actualizing potency. She is his power of manifestation. She is everything that is manifest. She is the form of the formless and is represented by the color red. She is everything, he is no thing. The two are not actually separate from one another. The idea is simply a device that is used for the sake of describing these specific aspects of consciousness absolute. Consciousness absolute is the supreme Shiva Shakti. Number 91. Shiva says, the syllable gu means beyond attributes, while ru means without form. Thus, the guru is the one who bestows freedom from the bondage of forms and attributes. Kindly allow this, Swami, to say, although you have earlier heard Gu and Ru defined differently, Shiva is now taking Parvati's mind into a different direction and widening the perspective. Okay? Again, so much of Sanskrit is metaphorical, and without the proper context, you will not understand fully what is being said. Number 92, Shiva says to Parvati, O dear one, know that Sri Guru is Lord Shiva himself. Despite his not having an eye in his forehead, it should be remembered that he is Lord Vishnu, though having only two hands, and that he is Lord Brahma, although without four faces. Swami Anantananda's commentary. The Guru is that Paramashiva. Paramashiva means beyond Shiva, who is everything from the gods down to the worm, the insect, and the blade of grass. Paramashiva is also the entirety of the universe that they inhabit. The Guru is Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma all at once. He needs not take on the physical characteristics attributed to the deities in order to accomplish this. This makes sense because these aren't actual physical entities in the first place. This is so simply by merit of the fact that he knows himself as that, with a capital T, which encompasses all else. 93. Shiva continues. May my prostrations to the ocean of mercy, Sri Guru, invoke his grace and liberate the many beings from samsara. 94. Shiva says, just as the blind do not see the sunrise, the unfortunate lack the discrimination to perceive the supreme form of the Guru. Shiva says, the Guru is the savior of one's own family line, as well as millions of others' family lines. Knowing this, one should salute him three times each day. Numbers 96, 97, and 98. Shiva says, O Parvati, one should bow with devotion each day toward whichever direction the Guru's two feet rest. The disciple should worship his Guru with the eight-limbed prostration every day. By worshiping the Guru thus, one attains stability in the realization of one's own true nature. Saluting the Guru with their two hands and feet, chest, knees, eyes, head, mind, and words is said to be the eight-limbed prostration. 99. Shiva says, every day one should offer a handful of fragrant, blooming flowers to whichever direction the Guru is residing. Where Bhagwan, another name for God or Lord, is awake, is where you will find the Guru who, like the Emperor, is ever the witness to the cyclical drama of the arising, continuation, and eventually dissolution of this world. Number 100. Shiva says to Parvati, why practice all the different forms of breath control or pranayamas which are painful and cause disease. If the guru's grace is invoked and one serves him alone, all the difficulties in one's path will be destroyed and one will attain their natural state. Swami Anantananda is coming. Specific breathing exercises are a time-honored yogic practice that have been utilized to good effect by many on the quest for self-realization. Pranayama is a viable option. However, it is not necessary to give any conscious attention to such exercises because the guru path is complete in itself. When the personal guru bestows Shaktipat upon the seeker, it awakens his or her dormant kundalini, which then continues to unfold spontaneously according to the guru's will. As kundalini unfolds in this way, one might find that its movement through the subtle nervous system, known as the nadis, causes spontaneous movements, kriyas, of the body, which can include pranayama. In meditation or on the verge of sleep, for example, these occur quite independently of any conscious decision on the part of the individual to move the body in this way. So, while other paths teach specific kriyas intended to elicit the ascent of kundalini, it's the other way around in Shaktipat. In this case, kundalini is aroused directly by the guru and the kriyas follow. On this path, you don't do yoga. Yoga does you. Sometimes this scares people. Since kriyas may manifest as violent movements of the body, erratic breathing patterns, or the vocalization of very convincing animal sounds. Usually, these automatic kriyas are pretty low-key, but the extreme examples do occur as well. Either way, this is nothing to be afraid of. Because they seem to occur involuntarily, they are sometimes attributed to an outside source. However, this is only the result of one's own energy moving through their nervous system, albeit in an unfamiliar way. Although I have advised that one need not worry when this occurs, kundalini symptoms can be painful. A competent guru can remedy this by his or her mere intent. A competent guru, incidentally, it should be noted that kundalini is sometimes awakened inadvertently without a personal guru present. Judging by some of the anecdotes I have heard, this can be quite traumatic and painful. In these cases, it is advisable that one seek a guru who, as stated above, can direct the rise of kundalini in such a way it becomes manageable. Once on the guru path, one need not worry about how to arrive at the enlightened perspective. The guru effectively takes the wheel, freeing the seeker to simply sit in the back seat and enjoy the scenery. This is what Uppaladeva, in his Ishvara Pratyabhijna Karika, called the new easy path. To be more specific, Uppaladeva's new easy path is threefold. It consists of, one, the correct theoretical knowledge of Shaiva monism. Two, the practice of Shaiva yoga. And three, the maintaining of devotional love for the Lord throughout. It is new in that it introduces a new attitude toward the mind, the body, and the world when compared with the practices of the ascetic paths that advocate the repression of human instincts and emotions, forcible control of the breath and mind, starvation of the senses, and so on. It is also new in that it neither prescribes the Eightfold Path found in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, nor any puritanical discipline like that handed down in the Brahmanic Smritis, such as Manu. However, the Guru Gita simplifies this formula even further, as we will see in the next shloka. Well, speaking of the next shloka, it will be shared by this Swami with you next week. Thank you ever so much for allowing this Swami to be of service. Om Namo Narayana. Namaste and blessings.